All right, guys, we're going to make this intro brief per Dr. Todd's request. But Dr. Todd, just so you all know, he was the Pulmonary Critical Care Fellowship Program Director for years and an excellent teacher, voted so by the medical students for many years now. And so he's going to talk to us about interstitial pneumonia for those of us that are not in pulmonary.
Hopefully, I have some stuff in here for the pulmonary intensivist as well. But when Mike asked me to do this, Mike and I talked about trying to gear it maybe towards someone who's not necessarily in pulmonary medicine, but who sees these types of patients in the ICU setting. So that's what I've tried to gear most of the talk towards, people who aren't really specialized, so to speak, in pulmonary. But for the fellows that I look around here in our 3-year pulmonary critical care part, I'll try to put some stuff in here too. All right, so this is what I'm going to try to talk about. I think I have 10 or so slides, 8 or something, on just introduction concepts, a couple areas of confusion, controversy. And then I picked out these 4 diseases. Mostly what I'll talk about is the first 3, and then I just have a little bit on exacerbation of IPF towards the end. So when I was a fellow, the term interstitial lung disease was used pretty much all the time. As over the past 10 years that I've been trying to do some research in this area, educate myself a little bit, these other terms have come into play, and I think they're really synonyms. I sort of prefer the one diffuse lung disease. Jeff Galvin, I'll mention his name a few times. He's one of our thoracic radiologists who I've talked to a lot about this area. Sort of likes that term, but really these are synonymous. The reason I think that the interstitial lung disease term has fallen out of favor is because there's often overlap a little bit between a disease process which is in the airspace versus a disease process which is truly confined to the interstitium in the lung. So if you take a disease for you pulmonary fellows, like such as alveolar proteinosis, okay, which is clearly an airspace filling disease, but you go to the book chapter for interstitial lung disease, and pulmonary alveolar proteinosis is in the book chapter of interstitial lung disease, even though it's really an airspace disease. So I think there's a lot of overlap. We'll talk about organizing pneumonia. Organizing pneumonia can often fill air spaces, but then become incorporated into the interstitium. So there's just overlap here with these terms. So I think I sort of prefer the term diffuse lung disease. For this talk, I had titled it interstitial pneumonia, but I think they're really similar terms, with not sort of precise definitions. Along those lines is obviously the word pneumonia. So if a resident comes to me and says they admit a patient with pneumonia, I usually think of pneumococcal pneumonia. You know, this is the stuff that we're talking about here is non-infectious sort of stuff. So it's a broad, vague term. Unfortunately, probably not going to go away. So just need to remember for this particular field that we're just talking about, non-infectious stuff. Continuing that theme is this word fibrosis, which is also not completely defined in what's the overlap between interstitial pneumonia and fibrosis is very vague and poorly defined. But in general, when we think about fibrosis histologically, we're thinking about collagen deposition, these findings here, and radiology, these findings. And I'll show you several examples of radiology and histology that I think would fall under the category of fibrosis. Obviously, one of the diseases that I'm talking about has the name fibrosis, so idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. You could also call it idiopathic pulmonary pneumonia if you wanted to. So why is some of this terminology and why is this so confusing when you try to read about it or learn about it? And I think the answer is here because we do not have a complete understanding of the field. So I think it's what we try to do is use the terminology as best we can. We try to describe what we see. Most of the stuff that I will talk about is just observations. I'm observing this histology or I'm observing this radiologic pattern, and I might have an incomplete understanding of what actually the mechanism of the disease is, why they have one pattern versus another. You could contrast that with emphysema, which I think we would have a pretty good understanding of why patients develop emphysema. The elastase, if you believe in that theory, it's an upper lobe disease, usually in smokers. We think we understand it a little bit better. This field is not quite so much. Now, so I'm going to talk about some histology in the talk, understanding the difference between IPF and NSIP and OP. Requires a little bit of understanding of the pathology or histology. So this slide, the reason I put this in here is to emphasize that the lung, in a simplistic term, can only respond to injury in sort of a finite number of ways. So the lung can only respond to injury in a finite number of ways. So I think this is a pretty inclusive list of how the lung could respond to some sort of injury. And these are just patterns of histology that you will see if you look at it under the microscope. The ones we're going to talk about today are this usual interstitial pneumonia, nonspecific interstitial pneumonia, and organization. But these are just patterns that you see under histology if the patient gets a biopsy. Several of these have an abbreviation, which leads to the so-called word salad of interstitial lung disease. Okay, so we have UIP and NSIP and OP and DAD, but they are just patterns of injury that you can recognize histologically. And my last bullet here at the bottom, it's often unknown, I think many, many, many times, why if a patient develops some type of lung injury, why they get a UIP pattern versus an NSIP pattern versus an OP pattern. Unknown many, many times. Patients with connective tissue diseases, for example, so scleroderma or rheumatoid arthritis, you see one patient with rheumatoid arthritis, they have a UIP pattern. You see the next patient with rheumatoid arthritis, they have an OP pattern. You know, why one patient gets one patient gets the other, unknown, in 2015. As I go through these three diseases, I want you to remember clinical term versus histological term. So, for example, IPF is more of a clinical term. The histology term that goes with IPF is this UIP pattern. I'll show you some examples. So, clinical term, histology term. And then second big issue in how we use terminology is whether there is an identifiable etiology to the patient's lung injury or whether we can't figure it out. So IPF, for example, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, sort of by definition is implying that we can ask a million questions and we can't exactly figure out why this patient has this radiology and histology pattern versus a patient that has rheumatoid arthritis who has some type of interstitial pneumonia, we would figure, okay, well, that seems to be, we understand why the patient has this interstitial pneumonia process secondary to some sort of autoimmune phenomenon. Another thing I want you to keep in mind as we go forward in the talk here is the idea that most of these forms of interstitial pneumonia are best addressed from a clinical, radiologic, and pathologic correlation. It's harder when you try to take one in isolation. So what I'm going to try to do is to give you a little bit of clinical information, show you some pictures, show you some histology, and try to correlate the three to come to sort of a consensus as to what term or diagnosis we think is most appropriate. I'm not going to say any more about PFTs for the rest of the talk. PFTs are absolutely, for those of you who are not in pulmonary medicine, absolutely essential to us understanding severity of disease, whether we would treat sometimes, whether we would not treat. But they're nonspecific, so they won't distinguish one form from another form. Really just used to assess severity and guide treatment decisions. So absolutely essential, but not really going to point you towards one versus the other. So I'm not going to say any more about PFTs for the rest of this talk. Again, for those of you who don't see outpatients on the pulmonary side, is how do we sort of assess severity of a patient? So if I'm in the ICU and we get a patient who is admitted with, let's say, an acute exacerbation of IPF, or they're intubated and they're on the transplant list for IPF, one of the first things I would try to figure out is how they were doing as an outpatient. You know, was the patient actually doing relatively well 2 or 3 weeks ago, and then now is overwhelmingly ill, or has the patient been just slowly going downhill? And if you look at the PFTs from a month ago, or you looked at the patient from a month ago, they were gravely ill at that time. So that information is helpful to me in trying to understand maybe prognosis a little bit, what's the likely outcome when they're in the ICU. So this is how we, you know, these are the things that I would try to figure out if I was in the ICU about what was going on in the outpatient setting, you know, how short of breath they were they on O2, zero O2, or 6 liters of O2? Had they been evaluated for transplant before? That tells me clearly that patient had an advanced form of interstitial pneumonia if they were evaluated as an outpatient for a transplant. I mentioned the PFTs. So if I'm in the ICU and I get a patient admitted with IPF, one of the things I will try to do is figure out what the patient's PFTs were a month ago. Okay, it takes a little effort, but many of these patients, when they come to the ICU, are there for 2 weeks. And my opinion is if you do a little bit of upfront work on the first day or the second day when they're there, you'll have a much better understanding of the patient over the 2 weeks that they're going to be there. So trying to understand their previous radiology, understanding their previous PFTs, understanding how sort of sick or not sick they were a month ago, I think is very helpful. Okay, so three diseases I want to talk about. So IPF, number one. Etiology in 2015, unknown. Been researching this disease for probably 50 or 60 years in the pulmonary medical field. Lots and lots of speculative ideas, but as of 2015, unknown. I think a typical example for, again, those of you who don't do outpatient pulmonary medicine, healthy 62-year-old man playing golf for the last 5 or 6 years, takes absolutely no medicines, healthy as far as you can tell, and it just starts to get a little bit of dyspnea and a little more dyspnea and presents and has these patterns of radiographic patterns in histology, and you and ask 35 questions as to potential reason, and the answer to every one of them is no. We just don't know why it happens in this group of people. I will say as we go forward, you know, sometimes I think the term here can be a little bit confusing, so don't get hung up necessarily on the name. I think you could call this phenotype that I'm going to show you with radiology and histology. You could call it any name that you want to call it. You could call it a person's name, you could make up a name. It's just we'll see characteristic imaging, characteristic histology in the right sort of clinical setting, and we just, somebody a while back said, okay, we're going to call this disease idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. I've alluded to this. This is my typical standard template for the social history. So us in pulmonary medicine, we like to ask a lot of social history questions. So if I get a patient in the ICU that comes in with a diagnosis of IPF, I would either ask the patient or I would ask the family member, if the patient can't speak for themselves, every one of these questions to try to figure out if I actually agree that this patient has an idiopathic form of lung disease. So it's probably not completely comprehensive, but I think it's pretty good. And there are lung diseases really associated with everything that's sort of listed on that slide. So by definition, if a patient answers yes to any of the following, most of the time, we are not going to say that patient has IPF. Now, if you want to ask a question, you could say, well, maybe they really do have idiopathic disease, and they had a pet bird, and the bird has absolutely nothing to do with their pulmonary disease. Is that possible? Sure, absolutely possible. But I think in general, we would probably say if the patient's answering yes to these types of questions, we would say that's probably why they have the particular lung disease, and we would move away from this term of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Okay, so histology. So remember, clinical radiologic histologic correlation is what we're trying to go for. So you ask all these, let me back up, so you ask all these social history questions, they're all negative. And then we have histology. So the histology pattern in IPF goes by this usual interstitial pneumonia term or nomenclature. The term probably originated in the 1960s, 1970s. You could ask, why in the world did someone decide to call this pattern of histology usual interstitial pneumonia? Unknown answer. You could call it unusual interstitial pneumonia if you would like to, but the term has, I think, probably been around 40, 45 years or so. And it's applied to this type of histology when, number one, sort of the first question I would ask, is this even lung tissue? So it often doesn't even look like lung. There is all sorts of cystic destruction of the normal lung parenchyma, which histology-wise we would call this honeycombing. So all these sort of cystic spaces filled with mucin. A lot of times that's what this sort of pinkish little stuff is here, mucin just filling these cystic spaces. And just the overall architecture of the lung is really completely gone. You can often find some sort of normal areas. So if you had high power under a microscope, you could find some areas of lung here, which might look pretty good. And one of the characteristic features is this heterogeneity between one part of the lung looking absolutely horrible and the next part of the lung looking relatively good. So that's a sort of low power. This is just another example, a different patient. Again, the first question I would have is this even lung? When you look at it, but this is the pleural surface, and so it is lung. This is actually a little bone, which you actually sometimes can see, bone formation in patients with UIP. So just the lung architecture is completely destroyed, and you have these cystic spaces. This is a higher power, more of these cystic spaces, cyst. This patient actually doesn't have that much mucin within the spaces. Sometimes you can have these aggregates of lymphocytes that seem to be next to these cystic spaces. And then this is a fibroblastic focus, Dr. Shanholtz. So it is if you all are in the ICU and patient has a prior lung biopsy and you read that pathology report and it says that there are fibroblastic foci in the biopsy, you should think that that patient has a UIP pattern. Okay, so from a simplistic standpoint, if a pathology report, or even better, if you look at it with the pathologist, get the slides, it'll be immensely valuable, and they see fibroblastic foci, really just make it synonymous with this UIP diagnosis. So this is what it is, this sort of paler area kind of in here. The thought is it's sort of a response to injury. This is just matrix that's somehow either being deposited or accumulating that just looks a little bit of a different color from the rest of the lung. This color is not quite as good as I would like it, but the thought is that there are fibroblasts, these spindle-shaped fibroblasts, through this sort of paler staining matrix. And if you look at these under a microscope or with a computer, on a particular patient, once you see one, My experience is they just start jumping at all over the place. Once you sort of see one and your eyes sort of recognize, okay, in this patient, this is what it looks like with this color stain, you just start to see numerous, numerous, numerous. They're often located in this little sub-epithelial location. They're often oval or round. And again, the color on this particular side is quite as nice as it is on your laptop or something. But this is often just... it's often just paler, much paler. The matrix here is more pale than sort of the part of the lung where that sort of fibroblast focus is not going on. Okay, so if the pathology report says UIP, this UIP pattern, very consistent with IPF, and as I mentioned, fibroblastic foci. Now, slightly confusing or slightly more complicated in that a UIP pattern is not synonymous with IPF. So what this means is it sort of goes one way forward, but it doesn't go backwards the other way. So if we say that a patient has IPF, if we use this term, IPF, we are saying, by definition, that the patient has a UIP histologic pattern. If they don't have a UIP histologic pattern, they don't have IPF, as the terminology is currently used in 2015. But it doesn't work the other way because there are some other diseases which can also cause a UIP or result in a UIP pattern. Okay, does that make sense? Sure? Okay.
So
I mentioned this idea of clinical term versus lung histology pattern. So the clinical term we're going to use is IPF. if we see that type of histology, and the histology term will be UIP. If you sometimes read the literature, you sometimes will see IPF actually slash UIP, some in some consensus statements and that sort of thing. I tend to personally sort of just use them as sort of a separate thing, clinical term, IPF, histology term. So imaging. So imaging on IPF is characteristic. I'll show you some examples. So we have these subpleural opacities. It's a lower lobe disease. IPF is a lower lobe disease. If you're in the ICU and you get a patient admitted with IPF, that says IPF, and you all look at the imaging, it is predominantly an upper lobe disease, I would say that patient does not have IPF. That would be one of my initial thoughts. This, whatever we think this IPF phenotype kind of is, the imaging and the pathology and the histology is in the lower lobes as a general rule. So UIP is a histology term described 45 years ago, but it is sometimes applied to the imaging. So that if you have a CT, which has some findings which I'll show you, you may read literature where the authors say the CT has a UIP pattern on the CT. These type of imaging things on CT, consolidation, masses, extensive ground glass, very unusual in IPF and really should make you think of an alternative diagnosis. Examples here. So peripheral disease. This is probably a little bit of honeycombing. Note how the sort of little bit more central portion of the lung looks relatively less involved or even normal, depending on how good the resolution is. Clearly, IPF is a peripheral, right on the pleural disease. A little bit more honeycombing. As the disease gets worse, it sort of may move away from being predominantly a peripheral disease. But if you see the patient early in disease, it clearly has this peripheral predominance. Why? Unknown at the present time. Is it a different cell type that's being injured? Different location in the airway that's being injured? Unknown. Traction bronchiectasis, often seen in these patients. So big dilated airways. So you should not have an airway that's this big extending to a few centimeters within the pleura. And the thought is that whatever going on in the lung parenchyma, whether it's collagen, whether it's alveolar collapse, whatever it is, it's pulling and tethering open the airways, and so you get this raggedy appearance and large appearance to these airways that are traversing the parenchyma. Don't know why patients have it. Whatever term you want to use for this characteristic imaging and characteristic histology, feel free. The general experts in the field sort of use this term, IPF, when we ask 30 social history questions and the answer is no, the radiology looks like this peripheral honeycombing disease and the histology has this UIP pattern. Next, NSIP. Again, this nonspecific interstitial pneumonia is a histology pattern and it looks different under the microscope than does UIP. I'll show you some examples. Look at this second bullet right here. It can be difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish by history and PFTs from IPF, but the CT is usually different, and the histology is absolutely different. In the next bullet here, so let me back up to IPF for a second. The CT right here. In 2015, if we have a patient, 60-year-old man, you ask all the social history questions, they're all negative, and we see this CT, we often feel like this patient does not need a lung biopsy. This patient does not need a surgical lung biopsy. It sort of fits into this phenotype that we call IPF, and we do not need a surgical confirmation of a UIP pattern. We would say the CT has a UIP pattern, and we think that's good enough. There are many case reports of patients with IPF getting VATS lung biopsies or surgical lung biopsies and having an accelerated downhill course. So that's always a concern and a risk. I think 20 years, 30 years of research has just shown if the CT looks like this, it will have a UIP histology pattern, and we often feel comfortable without a surgical lung biopsy. Conversely, this NSIP, we can really never probably confidently say a patient has NSIP unless we have a surgical lung biopsy. This is a normal lung, nice, narrow, thin, intraalveolar septae compared to this is what we see in NSIP. So this sort of widening of all of the individual alveolar septa. These are wide by either cells, and hence the term cellular NSIP, for those pulmonary fellows interested in the room, or collagen or other types of connective tissue deposits, and which often will get the term fibrotic NSIP. I think for most of us in the room, probably fibrotic is probably more common. There sometimes is overlap. I think if you just understand the idea of NSIP, it can be either a little more cellular, a little bit more fibrotic. Either one, again, contrasting with the sort of normal nice alveolar septa up here. Yes, sir? So that's NSIP, just another example. Different patient, normal lung up here. All of these intraalveolar septae are just too wide, too thick, and just I think you would all recognize that that lung does not look like that normal lung. So at low power, so that was sort of more high power. So this is what NSIP looks like at low power, and it contrasts with what UIP looks like. So the first thing I would say is I think probably most of us would always easily recognize that that's a lung, right? That this does not look like this destroyed honeycomb cystic piece of tissue that we're not even sure what organ that it came from. So, and it's sort of uniformly kind of abnormal. You can recognize it as lung. The background architecture of the lung is preserved. And then if you go to higher power, you just see all of these septae that are just either inflamed or fibrotic pretty much diffusely. So all of this area, I think any pathologist who looked at that would call that NSIP and then further characterize it as he goes to higher power. Okay, imaging for NSIP. So if you look at the bottom bullet here, I think a thoracic radiologist and any of you all that has an interest in this area, I think it should be pretty straightforward with some basic concepts to be able to look at a CT and to ask yourself, does this look like IPF or UIP or does this not? And so NSIP generally tends to have these features up here. I'll show you some examples. But it usually does not have that peripheral honeycombing that we often see in IPF. And it usually does not have the extreme periphery of the lung involvement that IPF does. And it often is a little bit more in this sort of peribronchiolar pattern. I'll show you a picture. One thing I want you to notice is see how the periphery of the lung is actually spared, or at least relatively spared. And that's, if you all remember nothing else from the imaging from this talk, remember that concept. IPF involves the extreme periphery of the lung, and NSIP and OP often spare, or at least relatively spare, the extreme periphery of the lung. So this is just some ground glass, which doesn't project well, probably some consolidation. This is another patient of Dr. Deepak's. I don't know, is Janaki here? But this was her patient, biopsy-proven NSIP, and actually even a little bit of OP, actually in that little area there. But notice again how the extreme periphery of the lung is spared. This is a higher one picture only. And I think if a thoracic radiologist or anyone with interest in this area looks at that and sees that peripheral sparing, they're going to say that that does not fit the phenotype of what we would use the term IPF for. Just another example, nonspecific. I think this is probably pretty decent for ground glass in here, ground glass here, ground glass here. Just throughout the lung without that peripheral predominance that we usually see in IPF. So summary for NSIP, Dr. McCurdy's slide, which I like that you fixed my slide there. So, different form of lung disease, similarities to IPF, very difficult to distinguish by history and PFTs. They're both going to be short of breath. They're both going to have restriction on PFTs. The difference is that the lung histology on a surgical lung biopsy will look different, and the chest CT should look different. Now, you all have been in medicine for a long time. You know there can be overlap. You know it's not always this crystal clean cut as we'd like to see it. But in general, we feel that a chest CT and lung histology should look different when patients would have NSIP and IPF. Beyond this talk really is treatment and stuff, but in general, the treatment for NSIP, we think whether it's either idiopathic disease or it's a secondary NSIP, in general, is going to be better than IPF. All right, questions on IPF or NSIP? And I'll finish up with OP. It's 12:45. That should be good. Okay, so organizing pneumonia, our third little disease, or I actually like this term, organizing pattern of lung injury. I'll show you why. So I put this back. So I gave a talk on organizing pneumonia to our faculty and fellows about a year ago, and one of our faculty said, why in the world is it called organizing? So that's a good question. So this term has at least been recognized at least since 1900, and when I looked it up, it actually was probably even 200 or 300 years before then, but it's in languages that I couldn't read. So it's at least as early as 1900, and I'll show you what people mean by that concept of organization. Fibroblasts within matrix here, usually round or oval, and usually intraluminally, and I'll show you some pictures. So this, I think, is a very nice picture. Some of our pulmonary fellows probably recognize this from my talk or Dr. Galvin's talk. So this is actually from Dr. Galvin's paper. So the word organization refers to what is going on in this panel C, right here. So A, B, C, D. So the idea is the lung gets injured, some injury, whatever injury you want to envision, there is leakage of plasma and all of the proteins that are in plasma into the alveolar space. And then fibroblasts somehow get sort of into the alveolar space, into this protein-rich fluid, and start to so-called organize this intra-alveolar injury problem. Okay? Why did they use the term organization? No idea. But whoever described it thought it was a good word to describe fibroblasts or mesenchymal cells. You might sometimes see that term, mesenchymal cells, getting into the alveolar space where they don't belong, and in this sort of exudate and trying to help with resolution of the injury. I think that is what organization is trying to do. It's trying to help resolve the lung injury. Sometimes these little areas of organization can then become re-epithelialized and actually incorporated into the interstitium of the lung, lending further overlap between what you would call an airspace disease and what you would call an interstitial disease. If something goes on in the airspace, then becomes incorporated into the interstitium of the lung. So this is what it looks like microscopically. So again, this sort of pale intraluminal collection of proteins and immunoglobulins and fibronectin and fibrinogen all in the alveolar space, and then all these little nuclei are fibroblasts that have gotten into the alveolar space. It's beyond this talk where those fibroblasts come from. I will be happy to give speculation if you would like. This is another picture. So background lung up here, and all of these little foci that are light purple on this slide, here, 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 are all foci of organizing pneumonia. Notice here that all slides are not exactly the same color. So, you know, why does this one look a little more red and pinkish and this one is a little more purple? It's just the nature of the staining that they use on a particular day. But almost always, the foci of organization will be a different color and not that difficult to recognize from sort of the background lung where that process is not going on. Another example, foci of organization, background lung. foci of organization, foci of organization. Foci of organization are non-specific responses to lung injury. So you can list almost any pulmonary disease that you want, and if you look hard enough on a slide, you may find a few areas of organizing lung injury. So the key here is the way I think about it is the pathologic entity that we call organizing pneumonia is diagnosed when multiple foci of organizing lung injury are the predominant histologic findings. So if I have a patient in the ICU that comes in and let's say they carry a diagnosis of asbestos exposure and you think they have asbestos, and for whatever reason the person gets a lung biopsy and the pathologist says there's one focus of organizing lung injury, that's fine. The patient has asbestos-induced lung disease. And that little focus of organizing lung injury is just a nonspecific response to lung injury. Patients that we call organizing pneumonia have multiple foci of organizing pneumonia throughout the entire biopsy thing, and in the absence of other histology findings that we would use different terms for. My suggestion, ignore it, or you can heed it. If you see histology, I would sort of use the term foci of organizing lung injury. It's a histological description, and maybe use organizing pneumonia as more of a clinical term when multiple foci of organizing lung injury are the predominant histologic findings. All right, background lung architecture should be relatively preserved. So this looks like pretty good normal lung. Does not look like this UIP, honeycombing, IPF sort of phenotype. You look down here, it's abnormal. You go to higher power, and you see these sort of foci of organizing pneumonia, or foci of organizing lung injury, better term. Okay, OP on imaging. So several non-specific patterns. So IPF has characteristic radiology findings. OP on imaging really does not. We can see reticulation. You can see ground glass. You can see consolidation. You can see focal nodules. So one of the fellows and I actually did a little research project looking at patients with OP, and we had 10 patients that just had a solitary pulmonary nodule. You would think it's lung cancer, looking at the CT, and they would have it resected because they thought it was malignant, and it was the most beautiful OP histologically that you could see. So it can really come with a multitude of imaging patterns. Consolidation. This patient had organizing pneumonia on surgical lung biopsy. This doesn't project very well, but this is sort of consolidation sitting up to the chest wall. This patient has sort of a combination of sort of ground glass, probably even a little traction bronchiectasis here, a little bit of consolidation, organizing pneumonia, multiple foci of organizing lung injury on biopsy. This patient, multiple pulmonary nodules. This little radiographic appearance here is sometimes called the reverse halo sign for you pulmonary fellows here. Dr. Papali, what's the name of that? I think it has a proper name. ATOL sign, I think. A-T-O-L-L. Is that right? So the idea, there's something called the halo sign where the middle of it is solid and there's more of a halo around the outside. This is sometimes called a reverse halo sign, which is supposedly somewhat specific for organizing lung injury on biopsy. So as you can see, there are a variety of radiologic patterns and not anywhere near as characteristic as IPF. In general, we think it has a better prognosis than IPF in general, but we also see patients that have organizing pneumonia that progress and don't respond to therapy. To conclude your thought process as you go forward and see people in critical care units and understand the terminology. If you see a pathology report, or you see a pathology slide of which there is a UIP pattern, ask all these million social history questions and try to figure out whether you think there is an identifiable etiology or an unidentifiable etiology. If we have a UIP pattern and we can't figure out why they have it, we use this term IPF. If you want to use the term idiopathic UIP, that would be perfectly acceptable. Perfectly acceptable. If they have a UIP pattern secondary to an identifiable insult, we would say they have UIP secondary to scleroderma, UIP secondary to rheumatoid arthritis, and we would not use this term IPF, or at least it would not be the best way to use the term IPF. Similarly, pathology report says NSIP pattern, ask 30 social history questions. If the answer is no, we would say that patient has idiopathic NSIP. CT looks a little different. Lung histology looks a little bit different. If we can identify an etiology, we would say the patient has NSIP secondary to whichever type of insult that you seem to think they have. And then very similarly for OP, you get a lung biopsy. There is multiple foci of organizing lung injury. We ask 100 questions. It's all no. We would call that cryptogenic OP. If you like the term COP, that's fine. If you like the term COP, that's okay. Or you could call it idiopathic OP, which is really what you think this is. The patient has OP, and I sort of can't figure out why they have it. And then likewise, if you think they're taking amiodarone, or they had some toxic inhalation, or they have rheumatoid arthritis, we would say they have organizing pneumonia secondary to that phenomenon. So in 2015, this is just sort of how we use the terminology for each of these three histology patterns. And that's the last slide was just so that you don't leave thinking that there are only three forms of lung disease. Obviously, when you see a patient in the ICU that has lung disease, there's a million causes. But I think these are the three that I talked about are often the ones that probably lead a little more to respiratory failure, referred from outside hospitals, maybe on transplant lists, and that sort of thing. So, all right, well, I hope that was helpful. If anybody has any questions, feel free to come down. I'll do my best to answer them. Thank you very much, all. Have a nice afternoon.